Location tracking, ECG success stories. A startup leaves its customers stranded. The Monopoly Man goes to Congress. And Taylor Swift owns your face. All that and more coming up on Tech News Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 61, recorded Thursday, December 13th, 2018.
This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by LastPass. Secure every password-protected entry point to your business. Join over 43,000 businesses and start managing and securing your company's passwords today. Learn more at lastpass.com/twit.
And by privacy.com. Stop using the same card number everywhere. Use Privacy virtual cards and get a $5 credit off your first purchase. Learn more and sign up in under a minute with your debit or checking account at privacy.com/TNW.
And by Command Line Heroes, a podcast from Red Hat. Listen to the epic true tales of the developers, programmers, hackers, geeks, and open source rebels revolutionizing the technology landscape. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and visit redhat.com/heroes today. Welcome to Tech News Weekly. This is the show where we talk to the people making and breaking the biggest tech news. I'm Megan Maroney.
I'm Jason Howell. Let's do it.
Yes, let's get to it. So in 2017, I brought my then 13-year-old daughter to the Women's March in D.C., and I have this very clear memory of her Snapchatting the crowd. She had this huge smile on her face, and all I could think about was that the information that she was giving was in this play, that she was in this place, was going up to the cloud, being saved forever. And I thought, what if someday we lived in a world where this fact could get her in a lot of trouble? But of course, already we live in a world right now where the wrong person knowing your location can be dangerous, and you do not even need to Snapchat a picture of yourself for someone to know where you are. This week, two New York Times reporters revealed their in-depth investigation into location tracking, and one of those reporters is here to tell us about it. Welcome, Jennifer Valentino DeVries, reporter at the New York Times. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you guys so much.
So you just start in the beginning. Where did you... Why did you start to follow this story?
Well, I had actually written a story about a different location company than we're covering in this story. In the spring, I covered a company called Securus that gets data from the cell carriers and location aggregators. And so that's the cell network data. And eventually it wound up in the hands of law enforcement, and they were using it to track people without warrants. There was a sheriff who had tracked a bunch of other law enforcement officers that he had a beef with, and it was a bad scene. So I had written that story, and I started getting tips about the location data space and how data like this was being used. And, you know, we just started digging into it further to see what was there. And it turned out a lot was there.
everything was there.
Exactly. Right. So I heard you talk about this on the Daily podcast, the New York Times podcast. And you said, you know, you started to ask these companies, you and the other reporter, Natasha Singer, started to ask these companies to tell you more about this. And you both got kind of a like, don't worry your pretty little heads about this. It's fine. Everybody knows about it. And so you went online and started looking at some webinars. Tell us what you found in the webinars.
Well, it's funny because even companies, if they're not eager to talk to the press, will they need to talk to clients. So I find in a lot of reporting that looking at marketing materials can be helpful for figuring out what companies are doing. And so they were talking about the power of this location data and how they could pull out people from the data. And I want to emphasize that they didn't say that they were using anybody's name or anything like that, or their phone number. they were pulling out an anonymous person, and what's important to them was not that person's name necessarily, but what they were doing in terms of their path through the day. So you could figure out what stores they went by. So you might serve an ad to them if you're one of those stores. And you could figure out if they really like coffee shops, or if they go to a lot of running stores or go to the gym. They might be a health enthusiast and things like that. These folks were talking about the power of their data, and sometimes they would candidly discuss, some of their privacy concerns that they weren't so willing to talk about with us as well. So that turned out to be some fertile ground for this report.
Now, the defense on this, often what you hear is that, well, the data is anonymized, and because it's anonymized, that means that there's no tracking information to know. Like, a lot about random person's movements through the world, but you don't know who that random person is. But there are ways to kind of work through that data and de-anonymize it, right? I mean, I don't know who would have access to that data to do that in the first place, but it can be done.
Right. I think, I don't know that most marketers who I think are the biggest beneficiaries of this data collection, they don't care what my name is, right? And they don't care about me as a person. But I think the danger we showed is that if you have data like this, even if it's just associated with a device ID as opposed to a phone number or name or address, you can see where somebody lives. Obviously, their phone is going to be at their house most of the time at certain hours and at their workplace if this is a typical person. And, you can identify a lot of people this way. And I think the risk is, not that a marketer is going to figure out who you are and track you down and be, targeting you and knowing who you are. I think one big risk is that employees at these companies or at the clients that receive the data can look people up. And I think that kind of information, sort of stalking of ex-boyfriends or ex-girlfriends is a potential problem, and people need to be aware of that. And there are also concerns with this information getting hacked. It's not the widespread sort of identity theft concern with some other data, but I think if you have a targeted attack, a target that might be in a location data set, you could try to get access to that and track them. In this data, we were able to find people who were traveling with the mayor of New York City. And this was just a pretty small portion of data that was limited to New York. It's not like we got Washington, D.C. or something, right? So I think there are a number of risks there that people need to be aware of.
Someone in our chat room said, just jokingly, can you believe that they're doing this thing I signed up for? So that's the argument we're having here. Like, you signed up for this. You're using the free service. But you go into the fact that this isn't as transparent as it needs to be. And even if it is, it's still something that we should be concerned about.
Right. I think that people are aware that their location data is being collected to a degree. They know that you look at a map, you have a blue dot there. It is clear that somebody is getting your location and it has to be sent there. And some of them even know that that this is being used for advertising. It's unclear to them how widely it's being spread, how many companies are involved, and how long the data are stored. I think that what we were looking at in some of our testing were the pop-ups that come up when people agree to provide their location. And in iOS, this is mandated by Apple. In Android, it's not. You just have to ask for permission to use location. But we found a number of apps that were putting these screens in aside from that pop-up. And what those pop-ups are doing are often only mentioning the uses that are like, you're going to get weather alerts, or you're going to be able to track your runs, or you're going to get traffic updates. So please enable your location all the time. And they don't add, and we're going to use it for advertising, and we're going to store it, and we're going to use it to sell to hedge funds so they can store it and analyze it. And, you know, there are some, we actually did see some apps that had that kind of information in there. So it fits in that prompt. And so, you know, if these companies were so proud of it and thought that users were super into doing this and knew what was going on, why would they not put that in the prompt when it fits?
Yeah. And if there are some apps that are doing that, I wonder how often that expanded prompt that actually gives that information really makes a lick of difference anyways. Because I think most people are just kind of like, yeah, well, okay, great. Thanks for the warning. Right. Let's just continue on to the free thing. Here's all my data.
Right. No, and I think that's true. I think people don't realize, even if they were to get something like that, what that data means. There's kind of an information asymmetry here. In which consumers don't conceptualize of how long it will be stored and how it can be put together to reveal things. But I do think at least telling people in a prompt that there are these other uses besides the really obvious ones, like tracking you at this moment to do this thing you're asking me to do, mm-hmm. I think that would be helpful.
Sure.
Well, so there's three levels of data that, you know, we're giving people, there's many ways we can give people, but I think about, you know, there are people out there who will be surprised if you say, you know, when you post on Facebook or Instagram, that information is used to sell ads. And then that's surprising to some people. And there are other people that, you know, but because that's a certain kind of information that you put out to the world, it's like, you know, your social media is maybe not who you really are. And then there's like your Google searches, which are a little bit different. Like you might say, like, you know, how do I get rid of hemorrhoids or something. And, you know, it's like, that's a little more private. But this location data is something you might not even type into a search engine. And there's, I mean, that's the thing that really is shocking. Like, you talk to people who, you know, there was one woman who spent the night at her ex-boyfriend's house. And when you talked to her and you were, you know, she gave you permission to look at that, like, she, you know, she said that she felt ashamed about that. You know, it's just like the fact that they're selling things on the backs of this private information. That's what I think is upsetting.
Yeah, I think, there was another, we talked to several consumers for this story. They don't, you know, not everything makes it in. But there was another woman I spoke with who let us look at her data who had, in fact, tried to go through her phone. She's not even on Facebook. She had tried to select apps that didn't tell her in these prompts that they were using her information for anything else, she said. And she didn't have as many apps with location enabled on her phone, and she was still in the data. And, you know, other people, other consumers I've talked with, you know, you ask them to go in and look at their phone's location settings, and tech-savvy people might check those things frequently, but I think most other people don't. I mean, a lot of people would have things in there, like maybe they got some kind of map for the metro for a city they went to a year ago, and it's still allowing location in their phone, like to be collected from their phone, and it's always on. And I know that sounds really stupid to people who understand technology, and I'm guessing to all of your listeners, but these weren't, you know, uneducated people. They just aren't steeped in technology. And, you know, it's something that is easy to forget about when you have a lot of other stuff going on.
Yeah, especially because you pointed out in your article in one case, someone's location was being tracked 14,000 times in a single day, which isn't just intrusive, doesn't feel only intrusive to be tracked 14,000 times a day and as far as where you are, but also it could have a detrimental effect on the technology that you own and that you buy, and slowing things down and making your life kind of miserable in some minute sort of way, you know, on your phone.
I've got to imagine it's killing the battery.
Yeah, totally.
But I think the people who were tracked that frequently, phones, they'll send more updates if you're moving quickly.
That's true. Yeah.
And I think those are probably, you know, cab drivers and folks who are really driving around for work, like delivery people, something like that. My thought was, man, I hope their phone is plugged in.
It makes it 6 hours a day.
Like, yeah, I don't know. Like, they must be super frustrated. What is happening? So, yeah.
So you spoke to some of you spoke to many of the people that work in these companies. One that this quote just amazed me, that there was the Tell All Digital is a Long Island advertising firm that's a client of a location company. And he even describes it as living in 1984. So I mean, is this just sort of where we are now? Should we just accept this?
I think that my role is to make sure that people understand what is happening, even if they aren't technologists. If they're just people who are interested in this and educated, but not perhaps people who have this as their job. And so I don't really know whether we should accept this or not, but I think that right now there's not an understanding such that people can make a decision about an informed decision about whether they're accepting it. And I think that it's something we need to be aware of, even if right now the data is only being used to serve you ads. As the collection of data increases with the Internet of Things and just the spread of different types of technology that can kind of create this data exhaust, I think it probably becomes more enticing to governments and other entities that might find other uses for it. And so I think we need to be aware of it so that so we don't just get to a point where we don't learn about this and debate it as a society until all of a sudden it's completely out of control. So I think there's still a point that, we're at a point where it's not, this isn't the full extent of data collection, so I wouldn't give up on questioning it.
Yeah.
I love the term data exhaust. I've never heard that. That's a great, gives a like a real physical. I know, exactly. And so check out Jennifer's piece in the New York Times, and also she links to tips on how to stop these companies from tracking you. And if you think you know everything, check it out anyway, or send it to someone who might not know, because they're excellent tips. Jennifer Valentino DeVries is a technology reporter at the New York Times. You can follow her on Twitter at Jen Valentino, and you can send her confidential news tips at nytimes.com/tips. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you, guys. Thank you both.
Take care.
So after the break, we will talk about the ECG app. So just take your ECG. If you have the new Apple Watch, you take your ECG while you listen to me talk about LastPass. They are our sponsor. Data breaches happen daily, and password security can't wait. Make every employee on your team a part of your security solution with LastPass Enterprise. We use LastPass here at Twit, and I use it on my personal accounts too. I love how it works with my iPhone. It works with my iPad, my Mac. It works with the Surface Book that I am making myself use whenever I feel energized. And there's an app on Windows, too, and it works the same everywhere. It works anywhere that I plan to use to access my accounts. If you just use the personal account, if you just use your own personal account, you're worried about how it might work in the enterprise, I can assure you that it works pretty much the same. Every employee has their own secure vault for managing and accessing passwords. LastPass Enterprise offers centralized admin oversight, including the ability to set master password requirements, enable password resets, and restrict access when needed. If you're the person in charge, you can configure over 100 policies, access actionable security reports, create shared folders, organize database logins, SSH keys, software licenses, and business information. And of course, you know the LastPass password generator makes it easy to use unique random passwords that employees don't have to remember or write down. And the password autofill functionality makes it easier for employees to seamlessly use LastPass across mobile devices. No more copying and pasting from your LastPass app. You're done with that. At TWIT, we use multi-factor authentication. And by that, I mean that Russell, who's our IT guy, who makes everything run around here, he makes us use it with some magic power that LastPass gives them. So even if any of the employees don't want to use two-factor with LastPass, they have to. We have to use multi-factor for our LastPass account, whether we like it or not. I like it. It's fine. It's good. It's like broccoli. You know you have to eat it. You know you have to do it. Data is encrypted and decrypted at the device level. Data stored in the vault is kept secret, even from LastPass. More than 16 million people trust LastPass, the number one most preferred password manager. In addition to the enterprise solution, they also offer LastPass Premium for personal use, LastPass Families for your entire family, and LastPass Teams for teams of 50 or fewer. Take control of your business passwords and reduce the threat of breach. Learn more at LastPass.com/twit today. That's LastPass.com/twit, and see which product is right for you. And it looks like I'm still alive.
You're still alive?
Yeah, my ECG says I'm still alive. Oh, good.
I'm so happy it was working for
you. I have a really good ECG. I don't mean to brag.
Why don't we talk about it? The latest Apple Watch that was announced a few months back that Megan, of course, is proudly wearing today has a new feature that captured a lot of headlines at the time, the inclusion of an electrocardiograph, or ECG. Last week, the feature was enabled on those devices officially, and joining us to give us his early analysis of those functions is John Timmer from Ars Technica. Welcome to the show, John.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
It's really great to get you here. Thank you for taking the time. So first things first, why did the Apple Watch get released before this like marquee feature was ready? Obviously, they were, you know, one foot was in front of the other at that point.
Well, you know, to begin with, Apple has its own agenda for when it makes sense for it to release hardware.
Sure.
And in terms of not having the software ready, software is hard. Yeah. It's trying to figure out what your heart's doing based on one electrode on your wrist and another touching your opposite finger. And there's a lot going on in your body in between, you know, those two locations. And so there's a lot of noise there. It has to filter out to actually pick up the signal from the heart. And that was apparently hard to do. And they took their time trying to get it right.
Sure. And Apple is, of course, a company that works very hard to get it right before they take something public, unlike
mostly
this other company that I spend a lot of time with. Google products sometimes don't quite go to that degree. But you wrote in the past, and you refer to it in your article this week, about atrial fibrillation. Talk a little bit about your own personal connection with this health issue.
Well, atrial fibrillation is a heart arrhythmia. It's got a lot of unpleasant side effects. It's a major risk factor for things like stroke and heart attacks. And I like being alive and I like having a brain. So when I was diagnosed with it, I've really been fairly active in trying to make sure I stay on top of my health in this case.
Go for it.
So you describe that your condition, you can feel like when something's going wrong. So what is it? What is the ECG warnings doing that's different than what you just feel in your body?
My experience is that, yes, I can personally feel something. Not everybody has that experience. There's some people who are completely asymptomatic and don't know their heart's doing something strange, even though you think it would be obvious. In addition, for me, I don't necessarily know what I'm feeling. I experience a couple of different types of arrhythmia, and I can't necessarily tell based on how it feels which of those is happening at any given moment. And the two have very different long-term health risks, so it pays to know which you're experiencing.
And so then you've been monitoring this prior to the Apple Watch. What was the kind of equipment that you were using to do that? What did it take? I imagine it's very different than a little wearable on your wrist.
Yeah, when I was first diagnosed, the only way of handling that was to go into a cardiologist, and he would prescribe a week-long monitor with what's called the Holter monitor. That's named after the person who developed it. And that's basically a small portable ECG that has this sort of traditional electrode stuck to your chest that you have to wear 24 hours a day. And the hope is that even if your arrhythmia is erratic, you know, give it a week, it'll show up and they'll be able to diagnose it and see what's happening then. Over time, since I was consistently feeling something while it was happening, I was able to shift to sort of monitoring on demand. And that, you know, I'm using this little product. It's about $100, $150 that's got two electrodes, so it works similar to the Apple Watch. And that communicates its results with the phone. So you can look at your phone after taking an ECG and see what's going on. And if you don't know how to interpret ECGs yourself, you can always export it as a PDF and email that to your cardiologist.
Hmm. So what is that little device?
It's called the Cardia Mobile, K-A-R-D-I-A. And it's, you know, a relatively recent product, but they've got FDA licensing to, you know, use it for atrial fibrillation diagnosis.
And so is that the same as the Cardia Band for the Apple Watch?
It's the same company. It's the same, presumably the same technology and software underlying it.
And so how do those results compare, the Apple Watch? And I know it's been only, you know, a few weeks or maybe a week. How do they compare?
The output itself is very similar. You know, if you scan down the article, I've actually got images of my own heart going out of rhythm a little bit. And I've got them from both the Cardia and from the Apple Watch. And as far as, you know, given the resolution, so you've just scrolled it onto the screen and you can see that there's a rapid succession of beats there as opposed to nice, evenly spaced ones. So as far as I can tell, the two give me extremely similar information in that I can tell that's not atrial fibrillation and therefore it's the other type of arrhythmia I have, which is premature atrial contractions. I'm sure a cardiologist would be able to tell you more than I can. This is obviously not what I do for a living.
Yeah. And so then I guess, you know, from a confidence factor, like this is your health that's on the line, obviously. Do you feel in the short amount of time that you've been using the Apple Watch to kind of track this, do you feel confident in what you're seeing? I imagine it's going to take time for you to be fully confident, but sounds like you're at least somewhat pleased with what you're seeing here.
Yeah, you know, based on using the Cardia for a while, I had an expectation of what the premature contractions should look like on these traces. And, you know, as soon as I saw the Apple Watch's output, it looked exactly like what I was expecting. So I felt that I knew what I was looking at and it corresponded to the physical symptoms I was experiencing. So as far as I can tell, everything looked great there. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I'll want to see something similar with atrial fibrillation and, you know, be able to confirm that they're showing the same things. The other thing is I need to send a few of these on to my cardiologist and make sure it gives them what they want to see out of it.
Sure. Really important.
So I've been taking my ECG like 4 or 5 times a day, even though it's always normal. And that's a symptom of anxiety. So so it always says sinus rhythm and gives around the same number. But you say that there's some different information that it would give me in the phone than it just gives me in the app.
So not necessarily different information. You know, it will tell you sinus rhythm in both those cases. On the phone and on the watch. But if you wanted to actually go through and look at the trace proper, you have to rely on the phone for that. You can't go back and look at what it just recorded on the watch itself. And for me, that's rather important because, you know, those graphs, those traces you just saw with the obvious unusual heartbeat pattern, those are sinus rhythm. You know, it's happening at the wrong time, but the actual flow of electricity through the heart is relatively normal. So those get rated as sinus rhythm. Mm. But, you know, just knowing sinus rhythm doesn't tell me what my heart's actually doing there.
All right. So obviously Apple's doing something really, really cool, really useful, unique, especially for someone in your position, in your shoes. How do you think Apple could take it one step further if they wanted to kind of push the boundaries and be like, all right, you know, last year we had this amazing feature. This year we're expanding on that. Like, does anything come to mind as far as how they could improve on this even more?
It's a really difficult challenge because, you know, to get the data they have now, you have to have one of your hands on your watch. And it's hard to imagine, you know, arranging for that to happen sort of accidentally. It has to be something you're doing intentionally.
Right.
And that's going to limit what they can do. You know, you're not going to be able to check your ECG while sleeping. You're not going to be able to have it done automatically in the background. So it's not clear how much more they can do with, you know, that feature itself. What will be interesting is that presumably on an anonymized basis, they'll have, and if you allow them to, they'll have access to, you know, traces from countless number of people. I think this is a public health experiment on a scale we've never seen before in some ways. And so, you know, it'll really depend on whether there's other information they can extract from those traces that, you know, might really tell us something about the heart's health. And, you know, when that happens, obviously they'll have to go to the FDA for approval if they actually want to tell users about what they're seeing. But that's something I could see potentially expanding the utility of this. It wouldn't necessarily be useful for me since I already know what, you know, my heart's doing. But for other people, there might be some value there.
Absolutely. John Timmer with Ars Technica. John, it was really awesome to get your perspective on this. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Great. Thanks again for having me on.
Absolutely. And we'll keep in touch and bring you back real soon. This was awesome. Thank you. Up next, how living the digital nomad life literally left some people stranded. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by privacy.com. You don't use the same password everywhere, at least you shouldn't be. So why use the same card number when you shop online? Privacy.com generates a brand new virtual Visa card number for every purchase that you make online with just one click. And it's super simple, super easy. You just download their browser extension from the Chrome Web Store, or there's also an Android iOS app as well, and link your virtual cards to your U.S. checking account or your debit card. And that allows you to do a whole bunch of really cool things. You can freeze and unfreeze cards and set spending limits per charge, per month or per year. With privacy.com, you don't have to worry about being billed twice or even upgraded without your consent. And there's no need to worry about forgetting to cancel subscriptions or free trials again. Refunds work even if the card is closed or paused, and you can earn up to 5% cash back. So those virtual cards, they're locked to a merchant, so you don't have to worry about changing your card everywhere if one gets hacked. It's just locked into a single merchant. You'll get a decline email or a push notification if the hacker tries to use the card somewhere else. And you can even figure out when merchants likely got hacked, even, you know, in many cases before they know themselves. You'll kind of get those signals and you can act on it. The security of your data is at the core of what privacy.com does. They're PCI DSS compliant and they're held to the same security standards as your bank. Sensitive information is secured, of course, using military grade encryption. Information is encrypted using split key encryption with partial keys held by separate employees. No single person can access the sensitive data on the server because it requires multiple keys to decrypt, kind of like, you know, the movie War Games, the nuclear launch codes in War Games. And true to their name, these cards let you use any billing information that you like, so your information remains secure and private. Privacy.com believes customers should have full control of their data, so they provide their customers access to transaction data via a webhook API, and they support two-factor authentication. Privacy.com is only available in the U.S. and 100% free to use. Just like credit cards, they make money from merchants, so they're not going to sell your information. There are no hidden fees, and Privacy.com has saved customers over $100 million in unwanted and unauthorized charges due to compromised cards, hidden fees, and forgotten subscriptions. So protect your privacy and your money with virtual cards from privacy.com. You can learn more and get a $5 credit off your first purchase by visiting privacy.com/TNW. That's privacy.com/TNW. And we thank privacy.com for their support.
Who among us hasn't dreamed of becoming a digital nomad? One startup called WeRoam planned to make that dream a reality for only about $2,000 a month. Unfortunately, the company went under, as most startups do, leaving many of their customers stranded in various countries with no way to get home. Most startups do not do that. Ellen Hewitt, reporter at Bloomberg Businessweek, wrote about this story, and she's here to tell us all about it. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what was the business model for WeRoam?
Right. So WeRoam pitched this idea that, you know, if you were interested in doing the digital nomad lifestyle, or maybe you have a job that allows you to work remotely, they would plan these trips and you could come on the trips for any period of time. And basically for about $2,000 a month, plus an upfront deposit of another few thousand dollars a month, they would book the place where you would stay. And they would plan a few activities for you, pay for your airfare in between countries. And basically this group of travelers, somewhere between 20 and 40 people, would move every month to a different country. And so you sort of get like an itinerary and you get travel buddies and you get actually set up with a workspace every month as well. So these were for people who were interested in exploring the travel while working lifestyle, but maybe wanted some training wheels.
And so one woman you talked to got to her destination and just got an email from the founder. Explain what the email said.
Right. So this woman, and this happened to a lot of the people I talked to, I interviewed a lot of people who were on trips, you know, maybe several months in, when all of a sudden, you know, they had actually just landed in their next country. There were four different trips going on. And they woke up and it was a Monday morning and they got this email from the founder of WeRoam, who's a guy named Nathan Yates. And it said, urgent message from the CEO. And it really cut to the chase. It was like, we've run out of money. Our dream can no longer continue. Our company can no longer continue. You will have your housing for the next month. But actually not the workspace, because there were some issues with getting that set up. You will have your plane ticket to your next destination in a month from now, but there's nothing set up for you there. We're winding down immediately. All our employees no longer have jobs. It was like a huge shock to the people who both worked for that company and people who were depending on it to make these plans for trips that they had, in some cases, planned to be on for a year, right? And there were some people who had even just left their homes to start on these trips, had arrived at their first destination. They're so excited. And then they find that actually this company has shut down and is no longer going to be able to help them.
And were there any like signs along the way? Like, I know you mentioned something about a rebrand that happened that was one signal, but I mean, the people that were using the service that you spoke to, did they kind of clue in on things at all leading up to this, or it was a true surprise when it finally happened?
Well, you're right that the rebrand was a big signal for them. That was about 2 or 3 months before the eventual shutdown. They were sort of just told, like, okay, the company's rebranding. Here's the new name. They went from WeRoam to WeCo. And, you know, in the blog post that the founder made about the name change at the time, there was some allusion to maybe intellectual property issues, but it wasn't really explored. A lot of people didn't really know what it meant, but just figured, like, okay, maybe it'll be okay. A co-founder also left the company around the same time, which also raised some eyebrows. But, you know, most of the customers I talked to said, like, you know, hindsight's 20/20. Of course, now maybe they look back on some of the things that slipped through the cracks.
Sure.
And think, like, okay, maybe the company was running out of money. But I think many people knew it was a startup and didn't expect everything to be perfect. So, you know, in fact, I talked to an employee or a former employee who said, like, it's just, you know, it is hard to tell if a company is right on the edge if the people who are running it are intent on not making that clear. So he said that he thinks that, like, this is the sort of thing that happens all the time. Like, companies can go under without people who work for them or maybe are even close to them as customers having any idea.
Mm-hmm. So what happened when you reached out to Nathan Yates, the co-founder?
So he declined to comment. We did actually get a lot of information about what happened and why the company shut down and what was happening after that from emails that he had sent to customers, you know, both informing them, you know, the actual email saying we're shutting down and here's why. There are a couple different versions of that email that I saw. And it actually is pretty detailed as to why the company started losing money. So it launched in 2016 and started running trips in early 2017. And around that time, it was hit with a lawsuit from a competitor, Remote Year, who is by far the biggest company that's offering sort of this digital nomad lifestyle product. And it claimed that WeRoam had stolen trade secrets by hiring an ex-employee of Remote Year. And so they were actually paying settlement money related to that lawsuit. And then about 6 months later, they were hit with a different lawsuit from Roam International, which has a similar business. And they were suing over the similarities of the name, so more of a trademark case. And that was actually what prompted the rebrand. So then the rebrand made it hard for the company to stay high up in sort of search engine results. And so they were losing sales. And, you know, it was just all these things that you could imagine. They're just sort of unlucky and maybe not well planned for piling up and making the company shut down. But yeah, Nathan declined to comment, which is totally fair. And, you know, based on some of his emails that he had sent to other customers who had been asking for updates about refunds, he was made clear to us that he no longer lives in the US. He lives in South Africa, he just said Africa. And he's actually now the CEO of a custom made surfboard company that's based in New York.
That was one of the most interesting parts of the story. You linked to his Instagram, and like, yeah, he owes these people all this money, and then here he is living his best life on the Insta.
I know. It's very interesting. I think, you know, one of the things that I learned, and I sort of knew in the back of my head, but when I was reporting the story, it was really clear to me, like, the way that the company was funded, it wasn't through traditional venture capital with equity stakes. It was pretty small. You know, it had been funded by personal money from the two co-founders and also business loans, so basically debt. And the co-founders had also personally guaranteed a lot of the loans that the lenders had been interested in trying to get basically extra assurance that their money was going to be repaid. So when a company goes under like this, it just doesn't have that much money left. And it turns out that if you're a customer of this company, and many of these people had paid in advance for trips that either, you know, they no longer got to see the second part of the trip, for example, or in many cases had paid for a trip, had not even left, were still working at home, you know, were preparing to leave for a month-long adventure in their lives, and then were told, actually, it's not happening. So those people, I think, were the most upset. They never even got to experience traveling in this sort of way. And so these people are, you know, they feel like the company owes them money. And I think that's a feeling that anyone could recognize and understand. But the fact is, these sort of institutional lenders or, you know, secured lenders or, you know, sort of the people who are giving debt, these are banks and other lenders, they have a much more stringent and a much stronger claim to any money that's left over at the company. And the fact is, there's also probably not going to be that much. So there's this whole complicated process about going into personal bankruptcy or having the company filed for bankruptcy. And I think the short answer is that if you're a customer, you're really out of luck. Like, many of these customers felt like, okay, like, I should have a right to get some of this money back, had spoken with lawyers and been told basically what I just said, which is all these other people who have more sort of well laid out claims to the money are going to be ahead of you in line. And there's really probably not going to be that much left. In fact, we looked at the personal bankruptcy records of the co-founder, so not Nathan, but this other guy named Sean Harvey. And he had filed for personal bankruptcy in August, so this was a few months after the company shut down, and was able to offload, I think, about $280,000 in debt. And this is, I think, a reflection of some of the personal, personal guarantees that he and Nathan had written out on these loans. So I do think, actually, the consequences for the co-founders are pretty bad financially as well. But they do also have access to various bankruptcy options. I mean, it starts to get very complicated. But I think when people see that they felt like they paid for a service and didn't have it rendered, and then the founder, Nathan, is abroad, and, you know, I think regardless of whether he is in financial dire straits or not, he's certainly, like, posting stuff on Instagram that makes it seem like he's having a great time. And that's a hard feeling, I think, for anyone. And so there are some unresolved feelings, I think, among customers about, like, you know, how can this person be starting a new company, be living what seems to be a regular life? I think we should also remember Instagram usually doesn't show what your real life is actually like.
No.
But nevertheless, people are looking, you know, customers are paying very close attention to what this guy's doing now and how it's all going to play out. Because he initially told them, like, hey, we're going to work really hard to try to get you refunds. And they just haven't materialized. The company has not paid refunds out to anyone. And it seems, as the months go by, increasingly unlikely that they ever will.
So you cover startups. I mean, and you point out that 90% of them fail. I mean, is there a trend towards more startups failing, or are there fewer people taking these kinds of chances? Where are we right now in terms of the success of startups, or does it depend on the startup?
I think it depends on the startup, and also, like we pointed out, the consequences for a company going under quickly can depend greatly on what the service is that's being offered, right? This is a very like physical and sort of life-sustaining service. I think that's why we had such a dramatic story when it went under. And there's going to be different ways that this story could play out depending on what the startup is. That being said, I think people who are thinking about starting companies, and there's a growing number of those people every year. You know, I was looking at the stats that come from the Kauffman Foundation. It's a good place that tracks startup statistics. And more people are considered sort of, you know, business entrepreneurs every year. And I think for a lot of them, they've only really seen kind of an upcycle. You know, that's for the last 10 years or so, it's really been a good time overall to start a business, regardless of the fact that many of these do not make it. I think that's just known. And so I think people are feeling like, okay, like this is my time. I can take my chance. And maybe if we were in sort of a different economic market, there might be a little bit more hesitancy. That's my best guess. Mm-hmm.
Ellen Hewitt covers startups for Bloomberg Business. She can be found at Ellen Hewitt on Twitter. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it.
This week, Sundar Pichai testified in front of Congress and also explained how the internet works to a bunch of old people. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Command Line Heroes, an original podcast for geeks by geeks from Red Hat, a company that has been bringing open source technologies to the enterprise for 25 years. Command Line Heroes are the developers, the programmers, the hackers, the geeks, and the open source rebels who are revolutionizing the technology landscape. The Command Line Heroes podcast is hosted by Saranya Barak, a developer who founded Code Newbie, and she lives and breathes open source software. Season 2 is all about living on the command line and tracking the changes that shape the world of open source development, from programming languages to learning about supercomputers, hybrid clouds, and so much more. On the latest episode, they explore what serverless really means, what developers can accomplish when someone else handles the servers. Andrea Passwater shares how convenient it can be to abstract away or remove from view the infrastructure components of development. Roderick Raba explains that going serverless can mean giving up control of your deployment and restricts your ability to respond to problems, which is why he helped create Apache OpenWhisk. That's an open source serverless environment framework. And Himan Chupant covers when to use serverless services. Visit redhat.com/heroes to check it out today. Subscribe to Command Line Heroes wherever you get your podcasts. Visit redhat.com/heroes for extras and to learn more. That is redhat.com/heroes. And we thank Command Line Heroes from Red Hat for their support.
Once upon a time, Google was represented by an empty chair in front of the Senate. Earlier this week, that chair was replaced by Sundar Pichai, CEO of Google, as he sat in front of the House Judiciary Committee to tackle questions ranging from data transparency to political bias and surge to Google's work on a censored search product for China. Joining us to pick apart Pichai's performance, perhaps with fewer P's, is Kurt Wagner from Recode. Welcome, Kurt.
That was a wonderful intro that you just made. Just everything about that was super. It was like I was watching a movie.
Then I've done my job, Kurt.
Yes.
Great to have you back. It's been a little while. Let's start with Pichai's prepared. I can't get away from the P's, apparently. Testimony. In his kind of prepared statements, he attempted to get ahead of what was to come throughout the course of the day. Were there any surprises there? Probably not. I mean, there usually are no surprises when they're as prepared as that.
No, nothing. I did find it interesting that he took a similar approach that we saw with Facebook and CEO Mark Zuckerberg, and that he kind of talked about this origin story of Google and how, you know, it was these two guys and they built it in a garage and, you know, the mission, right? So kind of humanizing the company, I think, in a way that most people don't always think of these big tech companies. And Facebook did that a lot. You know, we heard Mark Zuckerberg building Facebook in his dorm room over and over again. again. And I think it's really just an attempt to remind people that, hey, this company is, you know, built and run by human beings. And even though it makes a gajillion dollars and has all this power, you know, there's a human element to it. So I just thought that was an interesting strategy. But other than that, there was nothing in the opening statement that really, you know, surprised me.
Sure, sure. So we've seen... You know, we've seen others and, you know, sit in this hot seat. Mark Zuckerberg, of course, comes to mind. How would you say in aggregate did Pichai fare sitting in the hot seat compared to some of the others that we've seen?
He seemed fine. I mean, to me, he seemed relatively calm, and he wasn't like, you know, there were all these memes after Zuck went in front of Congress of him, you know, sipping the water, and he had these kind of like nervous tics a little bit where he, you know, yes, Senator, no, Senator, all this stuff. I thought Sundar was like very calm, and it may just be that like we're all sick of hearing and watching these hearings at this point that there was not as much like drama and scrutiny on this one as there had been in the past. I mean, there were a lot of people paying attention, but it just didn't feel like it had the same gravitas that Zuckerberg one did. And I think if you look back, you can tell basically by the coverage that happened after the hearing, there wasn't really a ton that anyone was super shocked about. Obviously, there was some important exchanges, I think, about what they want to do in China. But other than that, I don't think anybody walked away from that with any, you know, negative feelings toward either Sundar or more negative feelings towards Google than they had when they walked in.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the most exciting thing, I mean, at least on Twitter, was the Monopoly Man protester behind the person that wears the little monocle, which apparently I also learned from Twitter, the Monopoly Man did not have a monocle. The original one didn't, but the mustache and... so yeah,
can't drop the ball like that if you're gonna, you know, be distracting everybody from the real issues at hand. So I'm disappointed to hear the monocle thing.
When Pichai was asked if Google was biased, and his answer was no, not in our approach, which, I mean, of course, there, you know, that's a plan. He knew he was going to get the question, and I'm sure he had that answer. But well, what do you think he meant by that?
To me, it was very clear in that it was... there's no disputing the fact at this point that human beings have biases, and there are employees at Google that are very liberal, and that's now a public thing. And there's many employees in Silicon Valley that are very liberal, like more dominant, I would say, than conservative employees. And so I think what he was getting at there was that, hey, there are people have beliefs. We're not going to shy away from that. But at the same time, we are trying to, by the way that we're implementing this, leave those biases and to the side. And that was really kind of, I thought it was like a subtle but somewhat smart way to approach that, because all of the politicians, the conservative Republican politicians, were pretty much trying to poke holes in this theory by saying your employees are liberal and therefore your technology must be biased. He kind of came out and said, hey, well, at least, we're acknowledging people have biases, but that's not how we approach this stuff. Very subtle. Maybe I'm giving him a little too much credit for that little nuance. But I did think that it's something that stood out to me.
Well, the other approach is what Ted Lieu, Southern California Democrat, did during this. He hit back on the idea of bias in search by saying, if you don't want negative results, don't do negative things, kind of placing it upon the politicians in the room to say, right, hey, maybe you're the reason that you're getting such negative results. But in effect, does a comment like he kind of held a hard line and made a big splash when he had those comments attached to everything else that he was saying. Does that kind of in some ways let Google off the hook, though, for kind of its responsibilities around its algorithm and how it works?
Well, I think it definitely shows the disconnect and the difference of opinion between we kind of stereotype or throw, if you're a Republican, therefore you believe this, and Democrat, you believe that. But it has it's kind of followed along those party lines in this stance as well, which is if you're a Republican, you believe that a lot of these companies are biased and these algorithms are showing favoritism. If you're a Democrat, you think this is a huge waste of time and that it's distracting from the other more important issues like, you know, Russian election interference. And so what that to me signaled was more that this Congress is no closer to agreeing on these kinds of issues. And as a result, nothing's really going to change, because until there's agreement that, hey, Google or Facebook or Apple or whoever is doing something wrong and everybody agrees with it, that's when you're going to see a regulation come along. But, you know, this is just another reminder that half of the politicians in that room think this is kind of a waste of time. And so does it let Google off the hook? Maybe a little bit. But at the same time, I kind of feel that a lot of this stuff, at least around the bias implications or the accusations, are a little silly. And so I understand why there are people who feel that way. And it makes me think that we're not going to see any changes anytime soon.
Well, I mean, the thing that they seem to be mostly taking for granted is that a human who works at Google is naturally more biased than a computer. That because I just don't, I mean, there's bias. I mean, someone had to design these algorithms, and they're not necessarily talking about that. So it's like you take the case of, you know, when all those, you would search for Michelle Obama, and then someone had gamed the system in order for it to show pictures of gorillas.
Right.
And so a human had to go in and fix that, you know. So, and that human might have hated Michelle Obama, but they had to fix it because the computer couldn't understand. The computer wasn't biased and therefore was showing these pictures. And so it's like, I mean, that's the bigger question. And I think that's the point that maybe, you know, that a computer is biased because a computer is created. The algorithms are created by a human.
Right. It's a reflection of the people who make it. Right. And that's the most logical and the hardest argument to kind of get past on this bias thing, because you could sit here and I actually sit here and I don't think that these companies are sitting there purposefully squashing, you know, conservative viewpoints. But the argument that's hard to get around is that, well, if 9 out of 10 employees who built this algorithm are very, liberal and very kind of left-leaning, they might not even realize that their biases are being implemented into the service, right? And so, and that's not really something that anyone can measure. I mean, you can come up with examples of things that don't feel right and that don't fit where it should. But at the same time, it's kind of hard to measure that. And I think that's where these tech companies and where Sundar's answer, where he said, hey, you know, we're doing this kind of, the principle of this is legit. I think that's why he can kind of get away with saying something like that.
Yeah. So another thing that this hearing allowed for is some conversation around something that's been big in the news of recent months, Project Dragonfly, which is basically the censored China search project that Google has gone back and forth on whether they're actually planning to implement it or taking their sweet time or not going to do at all. Who knows? We've heard a lot of things unofficially about it, and now Google's talking about it slightly. Did lawmakers use this opportunity to drill deep on that? And what did we learn at that point? Was it all just marketing speak?
No, they did. There were a ton of questions about Google's intentions in China, the Project Dragonfly that you mentioned, and Sundar came out and said, you know, we do not have plans to go into China right now, and yet he also said we have, I think, like 100 plus people building and working on this or have been working on this in the past. So it's pretty conflicting there, right? It's like, well, why would you have 100 people working on something if you don't have any plans to actually use that thing? But what he did not do and what a lot of people latched onto was that he did not come out and say, we will never do this, right? He says, we don't have plans to do this. But when he was pushed to say whether or not, Google would ever do something like this, he kind of sidestepped that question. And so I think the takeaway from all that is that, yes, Google is building something like this. Maybe Google doesn't have a launch date in mind or they're still working out the kinks. But at the same time, it seems very clear that this is something that they want to do at some point if they can figure out the logistics around it. And so that, you know, makes people nervous for a lot of particular and obvious reasons. But I think, you know, what he did was confirm how serious Google is by not confirming how serious Google is.
Good. That's the job of someone leading a big company like that, I
exactly.
suppose. In the end, like, what was the biggest missed opportunity? I saw a lot of people who felt like this was just yet another one of those hearings where everyone said exactly what you thought they were going to say, which was nothing of true substance. Big missed opportunity to hold Google account to account for things. What do you think?
I don't know if there was a missed opportunity in terms of like questions he should have been asked. I'm sure that there are, you know, I could sit down and probably come up with some. I think the biggest missed opportunity to me is this lack of cohesion among, you know, politicians in terms of where do we actually go from here, right? So we have spent a good part of 2018 watching these big tech figures go to Washington, D.C., sit down and answer questions over and over, oftentimes the same questions. And yet we are no closer from where I can sit to actually having any kind of legitimate regulation or solution to a lot of these problems. So, you know, one example from Google was that it was very clear from all the questions. A lot of these politicians are shocked at how much data Google collects, and it's very troubling. They don't understand it. They're you know, appalled by how much it is, and yet there doesn't seem to be any consensus to kind of bring that back a little bit, right? Or say, hey, we are going to actually limit how much data you can collect and how much data Facebook can collect. So to me, the biggest missed opportunity is that there's so many people with different agendas here that there doesn't seem to be anything that's getting done to actually solve some of these problems. And instead, we're waiting for the Googles and Facebooks to kind of self-regulate. And I don't think that that's where we want to be if privacy is something that's important to you.
Mm-hmm. I just wanted to correct someone in the chat room pointed out that I conflated the two stories. In 2009 was the search results for searching for Michelle Obama. It was a photoshopped racist image that came up. And then there was the later issue with Google Photos where you showed images of gorillas when you searched for something.
Well, there was also the example that was brought up was Donald Trump. And I think if you search the word idiot, then Donald Trump's photo appeared. And so that was what was brought up during Tuesday's hearing. Gosh, I had to remember what day of the week it was. So that was, you know, obviously thankfully a less racially charged example, but nonetheless an example of, you know, using a search word that brings up a photo that some people find offensive in one way or another.
Right, but it's just the algorithm, I mean, that gets, you know, I think that's the thing that's so frustrating. The fact that this is sitting, they're sitting in a U.S., courtroom, like arguing over this when it is like clearly a global issue, and it's a much bigger question than I think what they addressed that day.
Yeah, and I mean, the fact that these algorithms are gameable is not news, right? And we have seen that this is what happened with the Russia stuff. This is what happens with viral fake news every day, is that these algorithms basically, you know, reward consistent behavior. And so if you post something and a bunch of people come and like it and share it and whatever, it's going to get more outreach. And the same thing goes for Google search. If you, you know, basically associate an image of Donald Trump with the word idiot, and then everyone starts to, you know, click on that or whatever, it starts to think that those things are correlated. And so these are errors, and I don't want to say errors, but these are just weaknesses in what an algorithm does. And so people are going about and, you know, basically manipulating them on their own. And so, yes, it's Google's fault, because Google is ultimately responsible for the algorithm. But this is not, Google did not say that Donald Trump is an idiot and therefore this should show up. People created that kind of correlation. And, you know, some people do it for a joke, or they do it to be mean or whatever it may be. But you know, these are human beings that are also kind of taking advantage of the technology. And, you know, that's harder to stop.
Yeah, absolutely. Kurt Wagner, always great to get you on, man. Thank you so much for taking time. Recode.net is where you can find all of Kurt's work following this and so much else closely. So thank you, Kurt. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Appreciate it. See ya.
All right. We'll talk to you soon. And finally, you know for sure that facial recognition has broken through from impressive tech oddity into the mainstream when Taylor Swift gets on board. Am I right?
You're right,
Megan? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So apparently people who went to see her in concert at the Rose Bowl in California earlier this year were scanned by one by one as they went through, actually, by a team in Nashville, Tennessee, that was kind of monitoring all this as it was happening. All this facial scanning was done to protect Taylor Swift from hundreds of stalkers that she is known to have. All the people that went to this concert, their faces were compared to a database of images of those weirdos. Not a whole lot is known about the process itself or the collected footage. Beyond that, what happens to that data, all that kind of stuff. One thing is certain, it didn't cross any legal boundaries since it happened in a private location, not out in the public. So basically, attendees had to be okay with it or risk their very own end game. missing the show. Hmm. You see what I did there?
It's Endgame, Taylor Swift.
I knew that was going to happen. Damn it.
Yes.
It is. The latest album, Megan.
Oh, it's called Endgame?
I want to be your Endgame.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, yeah.
It's okay.
I'm over T-Swizzle. She's so last year.
T-Swizzle. That is so like 2014 or something. I don't even know.
Okay, so this seems legit. Like you said, it's legal. But I read, I think, in The Guardian that the people weren't informed that their image was going to be saved.
That might be
and
a
they
different
did they did
story.
Say that it was legal, even though, because like you said, it's a public, like you can, you know,
you're
it's
in
private,
space, so
they can do whatever they want. Mm-hmm. But it still does seem like they didn't really know that their image was going to be stored there. And that seems a little, I mean, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, well, sure. Like I don't want stalkers to get to go to her conference, you know, concerts. I want them to, you know, be recognized. And, but like, we've just been talking about this whole time. Like if you don't know, like, what are they going to do with those images later? And, you know, are they accurate? Like, you know, it's just, how can they be misused? Mm-hmm. And maybe there's a better way. But, you know.
Yeah, I wonder if the tickets were sold through, like, Ticketmaster or what. Like, I wonder if there is, like, boilerplate copy in there that says, you know, you agree to the fact that while you're there, your picture might be used for this, that, or the other thing. You know, because I know I've seen that at concerts where you go there and they might be capturing footage for, like, a live recording or something like that. And by entering through these doors, you agree that your likeness might end up, you know, recorded for this, that, or the other thing. I wonder if that would be swooped up into this as well. Mm-hmm. People just wouldn't make the connection. They'd automatically jump to, oh, great, they're recording a live album and not, oh, they're scanning my face and comparing me against weirdos.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what happens to that data?
I like how you call them weirdos.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just a name. Stalkers. It's a name that sticks. Yeah, stalkers. Sure. And also, by the way, I know you already know this, Megan, but today is Taylor Swift's birthday.
Oh, happy birthday.
Yeah, happy birthday, Taylor Swift.
I had no idea you were such a big Taylor Swift fan.
Look, I have two daughters. We've listened to her last two albums too much, too many times. Save me, Burke, save me. Give me some good music to listen to, please. Tech News Weekly records live every Thursday at 2:30 p.m. Pacific at twit.tv/live. You can be part of the show by emailing us at tnw@twit.tv.
And subscribe to our show. You never know what's going to happen. You really have no idea what you're going to find out, that Jason secretly has a Taylor Swift addiction that he's trying to blame on his children. Sure. And if you want to tweet at me, I'm at Megan Maroney.
And I'm Jason Howell. Thanks to our TD, Josh. Thanks to Burke. Thanks to Jammer B. All of you for laughing at me. And thanks to you for watching. We'll see you next week on another episode of Tech News Weekly. Bye, everybody.